Welcome to Be With Champions. I'm your host, Greg Bennett. And today's conversation was a real highlight for me, chatting with the voice of cycling, Mr. Phil Liggett. He shares so many wonderful stories. I love one story when he talks about his first time doing live television commentary, and he was so enthralled by the race that was starting that he was actually the race director of that he forgot to speak. And it took a little while for him to actually to hear the producer in his ear while he held up the telephone to his ear, screaming at him to start talking. I just love that that's where he started out and to what he's become. Just incredible stories, story after story from arguably one of the world's greatest storytellers. It was just such a privilege to chat to him. A couple of things before we get started. If you want to go to BennettEndurance.com/media, you can get the timestamps there. You can get the show notes. The links that we talk about within the show can be found there. And also you can get the sponsors' coupon codes to buy any of the products. Please subscribe. Please share. You'd be doing a huge favor if you can help me out there. And I'm also loving the feedback. So please keep it coming, whether that be on your app of choice, iTunes or whatever it is. I can't get back to you on those apps, but I do appreciate and I am listening. If you want to reach out on social media, my Instagram is Greg Bennett World. My Twitter is Greg Bennett 1. And otherwise, Greg Bennett on Facebook or Greg Bennett on LinkedIn. And any of that feedback just really helps me out. And I'll get back to you the best I can with all of that. I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. Just, wow. It was just a big thrill for me to talk to Phil Liggett, the voice of cycling. Before we start, I've got to give a quick shout out to the brands that make this show possible. The only brands I'm working with are brands that provide products that I use daily and truly believe in. These products support my immunity, they help improve my recovery and my focus. First up, my friends at Athletic Greens. I love this company and I love their all-in-one daily drink. It's become a part of my morning routine. I'm heavily focused on supporting my immunity and boosting my energy and helping my gut health, but I want to do it naturally. And I found that support with Athletic Greens, a whole food sourced green drink that tastes great and there's no hassle. It's delivered straight to your door. And it's a highly absorbable powder that takes seconds to mix with water, so there's no clumpiness to deal with. I can't believe a green drink sourced from Whole Foods can actually taste so good. Personally, I truly love it. It's developed from a complex blend of 75 vitamins and minerals. It's packed with adaptogens for recovery, probiotics and digestive enzymes for gut health, and vitamin C and zinc citrate for immune support. So Athletic Greens is designed to help fill the nutritional gaps in your diet. And there's a great offer going on now for you to give it a try. Simply go to athleticgreens.com/Greg to claim our special offer of 20 free daily travel packets with your first order. $79 added value. And get Athletic Greens delivered straight to your door. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Greg. This show is also brought to you by my friends at Hyperice. Some of these products I've been using for almost a decade. Makers of the award-winning Hypervolt, the world's most powerful percussion massage device featuring Quiet Glide technology. Hyperice is a wellness tech company that makes devices designed to help you move better. From handheld massage devices to vibrating foam rollers, thermal technology, and the Normatec compression systems, Hyperice helps you warm up faster, recover quicker, and simply move better. Used in professional training rooms throughout the NBA, the NFL, MLB, the MLS, Ironman, and other professional organizations for well over a decade. Designed to help improve circulation, flexibility, and relieve tension. Get $50 off all percussion devices now, no code needed, and get an additional 10% off with code GREG10 at hyperice.com. That's hyperice.com, HYPERICE.com, and use code GREG10 for 10% off. And finally, I want to give a huge shout out to my mushroom buddies at Four Sigmatic, and they're tremendous supporters of this show. An incredible wellness company that mixes shrooms and aptogens with coffee, cocoa latte, protein powder, and even edible skincare products. One of my staples is a mushroom coffee with lion's mane. And wow, I just love how much more productive and creative and clear thinking I am. Plus, it includes chaga, which is the king of the mushrooms. Right now, chaga is my favorite functional mushroom. The compounds and antioxidant properties of chaga play a big role in supporting our immune system and maintaining its function. You're probably thinking, does this coffee taste like mushrooms? And I can guarantee you it just tastes like regular coffee and not like mushrooms at all. Best of all, Four Sigmatic stands behind their products unconditionally with a 100% money-back guarantee. Love every sip or get your money back. And of course, we have a special offer for you as a Be With Champions listener. Receive 15% off your Four Sigmatic order. Just go to foursigmatic.com/Greg or enter code Greg at checkout. That is foursigmatic.com/Greg to receive 15% off your order. All right, today I have a very special guest, a man who has played a significant role in bringing bike racing out of Europe to the rest of the world. For almost 55 years, he's been a cycling and Olympic journalist and commentator. For 47 years straight, he's been commentating the Tour de France. In fact, this is the first year in all that time that he's going to be home for the month of July. But he's more than just a journalist and a commentator. He's someone who has followed his passion, turning it from a hobby to a career. And you can just hear it in his voice. He loves the bike racing. He loves the athletes. He loves the scenery. He loves the history. He loves the team that surrounds him. And each moment of every race, he sees something unique and special. Look, I'm a triathlete, and that's always been my passion. But my love for bike racing is because of this man. There is something comforting about his voice. I feel incredibly honored and privileged to have the voice of cycling here with me today. Welcome, and thank you for joining me on Be With Champions, Mr. Phil Liggett. How are you, mate?
Well, thank you very much, Greg. I think you said it all. Should we say goodbye now?
There's nothing to talk about now.
I've finished my whole life in just 2.5 minutes.
Mate, I just, you know, it's come around to July and suddenly your voice is not here with us. And it was like, well, I better make sure I at least get to hear your voice on my show and have a chat about your life and celebrate your life. So I really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, I was chatting to my mum the other day and she says, look, every July I go to France with Phil, you know, and it's like, obviously that not literally, but it's like she turns on the TV in Sydney, Australia and, you know, she travels around France with you and it's kind of, it's sad in a way that we're not getting to have the Tour de France, but we're also not getting to hear your voice and celebrate what is one of the most epic experiences in the world.
Well, it's been a very emotional time, to be honest, Greg, because Twitter's gone mad. My account is constantly doing exactly what you say and your mum said. They're reliving the month of July with me because NBC, SBS, all the television networks are replaying the grand old days, great stages. And of course, it's the voice of me because I've done the Tour de France since 1973. Television started for me in 78. And most of that time, apart from the first few years, I was with Paul Sherwin. And so people are remembering my co-commentator as well, because, as you know, he died rather suddenly on December the 2nd, 2018. But I've been reading all these mails and things people say. I feel so flattered. And now after a couple of days, I was beginning to get pretty emotional. I thought, wow. Because I went into a shop only yesterday and said to the local shopkeeper, I said, well, this is the first time on this day I've ever been in England since 1972. He said, what are you talking about? He knew what I was doing for a living. I said, well, I'm always on the Tour de France. It's very strange. It really is very strange, but my garden is beginning to look rather nice.
It is. I mean, I think it's hard for people that are high performers in your kind of situation. I had Mark Allen and Dave Scott, who you know from the Ironman triathlon world.
Very great guys, really great guys, yeah.
And I asked them this same question, and do you kind of recognize the impact that you've had on millions of people around the world? I mean, sure, the athletes have been riding the bikes, but you've been adding that color and that romance to a sport that I don't think it would be the same sport without your voice. Do you understand the kind of impact that you've had on a generation or two generations of fans?
It's a little bit like an athlete who has natural talent, like Mark Allen, for example, because Mark Allen, if memory serves me rightly, he won the Nice Triathlon 10 years in a row. They have this extreme talent, and I don't think they realize they've got it. When Stephen Roach won the big triple, the World Championship Tour of Italy and Tour of France in the same year, in 87, he didn't realize what he'd done. And that's exactly what he told me 2 years later. He said, I didn't make enough of it, Phil. I didn't know what I'd achieved. And I think that's the same in my commentating. I'm very genuine in my commentary. And, you know, if I don't think the guy's doing the right thing, I will say that as well. But basically, I love putting people in a place in which they deserve to be. If they're champions by their nature, even just by having a big heart, then they deserve to be given the accolades. And I feel very proud of that when people will go to those guys and say, hey, we heard Phil Liggett saying you did this. That man's an icon. Well done. Then they appreciate the athlete, not me, but the athlete. So I'm very pleased it happened. I am conscious of it. But even so, I just love success. And I love guys who work their butt off to become champions, because there's no easy way to the top. You've got to basically not just have the talent, you've got to have a big heart and great determination. And you can beat the guys with a big talent if you've got it. So when that happens, I'll be even more enthusiastic. Felix Leviton, who was once the race director of the Tour de France, he used to love what he called the big adventurer. He was full of praise for a guy who'd break away at the beginning of a stage of 250 kilometres and maybe stay out front for 6 hours and be caught a kilometre from the finish. Those guys were absolutely superheroes, not afraid of anybody, willing to give it a go. Not the most talented guys, that's why they attack early, because they don't have the talent. But they had the guts and the ability to stay ahead and almost ride the field down. And I love those stories.
Oh, Phil, you've given me goosebumps just with that little that little monologue. So, and that's why, you know, I was so excited to get you on this show, because you are one of the world's high performers in your area.
Well, let me tell you though, Greg, triathletes and triathlons were not around in my career. I call it a career, but I was never a pro. I couldn't have been a success at it because I can't swim to this very day. But even so, I'm full of admiration. I got a great break when I was asked to do the Ironman triathlons, and also I started with the short distance triathlon, short air distance, like the Nice triathlon, because there was no guys really commentating on triathlons. And so CBS and British Television asked me would I give it a shot after all the cycling in it. And so I did. And I finished up commentating at the Olympic distance at the Olympic Games on quite a number of occasions. Every one of those guys was superb people to meet. Everyone had a great story. And everyone had a catalyst. And that was their pure energy to succeed. They were never racing the other person. They were racing their own body to get through that Ironman distance. And, stories came out of the woodwork. And the emotional scenes of going back at midnight to cheer home the last finisher in the World Championships in Hawaii. They were brilliant moments for me, and I love them throughout.
I can't wait to – I want you to come back. I need you to come back.
Well, I am getting old, as you told me at the top.
No.
All those years I've been commentating. I still feel young and I still ride my bike, but the fact is that next month I'll be 77. I can't believe it.
It's amazing how quick time flies. Look, some of the highlights for me was the 2004 Olympics when, you know, I think you were calling for Australian television and to have you calling my Olympics in 2004. And then in 2008, I was working for the BBC calling the Olympic Games triathlon. And I just called the women's race. And I think I'd seen you the day before leaving the media center because you were working for Channel 7, I think.
Yeah, it was either 7.
Yeah.
I think it was 7. Yeah.
And you were calling with Greg Welsh, I think. And anyway, I saw you in the kind of lobby area. What was that?
Another character, Greg Welsh.
Yeah, a great character and a very good friend of both of ours.
Just a quick aside, when Greg won the Foster Tuncurry Ironman, his wife won the women's section, Sean. And I went up to Sean. I was doing it live recording for American television, for NBC. And I said, Sean, that was absolutely fantastic. And she looked at me and she couldn't say anything. She said, I can't believe it. It's Phil Liggett is talking to me having the event. I said, well, we'll have to say something soon, Sean, because we're on television, so let's get going. And then, of course, that night was special with the future husband and wife duo having won the two respective triathlons on that day. What a great day that was in Foster Tuncurry. Anyway, sorry.
I love your memory, Phil. No. You can interrupt me at any time throughout this episode because I just love these stories. And I was just saying the second time was at the 08 Olympics, and I saw you the day before after commentating the men's race in the lobby, and I'm like, do I go up and say hello? And I wasn't sure if you'd remember me or not. But the next day you walk past, I just commentated my wife Laura, who'd finished fourth. When I say I just commentated, I commentated the whole race, but it was a hard commentary because I was talking about my wife. And anyway, I came out and I said, hey, Phil. And you said, g'day, Greg. And you knew my name. And I was like, oh, man, that felt so special. And I went back back to see Laura, who'd finished fourth, and talk. And I said, Laura, you wouldn't believe it. I got to meet him, and he knew my name. And you got to remember, I was in the Olympic Village with Laura, and we were looking at the American basketball team and Michael Phelps and everything. But I was still more excited about the fact that I got to meet you. So there you go. In terms of my pedestal of people that I got to meet, it was a real highlight for me in 08. Not only did I get to meet you, but you knew who I was. And I think that's something about your memory that's just incredible. It's like it's an incredible gift you have that you can remember so many faces and names and stories. Is that rehearsed? Is that practiced? Or is that something that you feel like is a bit of a gift?
No, I don't know if it's a gift. I'm a great admirer of guys who call horse races, how they can tell through a pair of binoculars across the pitch, across the race course, which guy is winning, how they can remember all the colours of every stable on the back of those horses. I'm full of admiration for them, especially when they commentate the finish. But it became much more difficult once all the cyclists wear the same colour helmets and sunglasses, and you can't see their eyes anymore. And you have to rely very heavily on the colour of the socks that they wear, or the colour of the sunglasses, or their actual riding style. And sometimes I look at the guy on the front of the race from, say, Lotto Soudal. I look at the list of the 9 riders or 8 riders these days in the Tour de France. I can eliminate at least 5 of them straight away on their size, and then I'm left with 2. And then sometimes I've got the best of 3, and I'll pot look it and just hope I've got the right guy on the foot. You've got to be honest, haven't you? I always used to say to Paul Sherwin at the end of the first stage, I hated the first stage of every major race I ever did on stage races when I sit down, I go through the whole list, as indeed did Paul Sherwin, and highlight all the guys who could possibly win a sprint finish, because it was maybe a stage for the sprinter. And I would then, we know that it's one sprinter per team. You've got to work out which one it is. We know basically who's going to lead them to the line. Once the colours hit the front, we should get it right. Sometimes it's not quite the same, but basically that's what we do on the first day. And at the end of the first stage, and you've got it right, I always used to say to Paul off camera, I said, wow, we'll have a great tour now. We got the first winner right. And off we go, you know. But it's absolutely a nightmare.
It wasn't always easy names either. I mean, some of those names, one of those names?
Abdu Japarov. Is that the one you're
going to? Japarov.
Yes, Jamaluddin Abdu Japarov. But it's a great name for high speed commentary. It rolls off the tongue. And here he comes, Jamaluddin Abdu Japarov. He's crossing the line in first place. It just falls out. It's a brilliant name for commentary at high speed.
That's brilliant. That is brilliant. And I can see where you get the horse racing admiration, because when it comes down to that sprint finishing, it is like a horse race. It is, you know, guys darting everywhere, coming at, you know, 60, 70 kilometers an hour, and you're trying to pick in. You're commentating from a computer screen, a television monitor. It's not like you're above overhead.
No, and very, very much smaller than the one in the house where you live. I mean, I think we're on about a 34 centimeter monitor. Whereas back home, probably 60, and not in the sunlight, you see everything perfectly. What's he talking about? Because we can often not see, we can only see the shape of the rider sometimes. We often put our coat over our heads and hide underneath, like the old-fashioned camera guys, taking pictures and making a dark room for ourselves. You know, we laugh sometimes when the sun swings around. Yeah.
I love it, mate. Look, before I get too far in, I just want to say thank you again. You know, late last year when I reached out and said, look, I'm going to start this podcast thing, you know, and want to give it a go. And I thought, well, who better's voice in the world than to have do an intro, mid-roll and an outro for me? And you were in your lodge in Africa, in South Africa, I think, and yes. On the border of Mozambique, right? And you went to all the trouble of recording the intro, mid-roll and outroll for me in this podcast. And I can't tell you the amount of feedback and people that have just loved the fact that Phil Liggett is kind of a part of the show. Immediately I went from kind of a two-star show to a five-star show. So I just want to quickly get that in before we get too further into the show, because I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Greg. I mean, that was a challenge in itself, because Africa, apart from, we live in a very wild place in South Africa, very, very remote. Of course, we finding a strong enough signal to do anything is an achievement in itself, but it worked, and that's all that matters.
It did.
We locked down after that because we overstayed our welcome in South Africa by nearly 2 months, 51 days, in fact, because of the COVID situation. The South African president closed the airspace, and we were marooned. Not that we felt marooned. We loved being in Africa where we were, but of course, all the bills were piling up back home, but I couldn't do anything about that till we got home.
It was crazy, isn't it? The lockdown that's affected the travel and things. But for, what I want to do now is just, I really want to wind the clock back. And the first question I kind of have is, when did you really find your passion for cycling? You know, were you a young kid? Tell me about that.
The fact is, it's an interesting story. First of all, I was not a sports person because if I played rugby, which was played at our school, I was the one thrown into touch rather than the ball. If I tried to play cricket, I couldn't bowl a ball, I couldn't bat. So I was hopeless at ball games. And don't forget, it's true, I couldn't swim and didn't want to swim either, which of course you regret now, but I didn't then. And so out of the blue, I remember going, I started riding a bike just because I bought a bike as a means of getting to school. And I rode every day of my life to school, except one Wednesday when I walked and I was late for lunch and late in the morning start. Other than that, I rode and was always on time. So my best friend, who was a year ahead of me in the school, came and said, hey, you've got to come and see Wales. Now, where I lived on the Wirral Peninsula, which is by Liverpool, between Liverpool and Chester, and behind Chester is Wales. And the most beautiful mountains you'll ever see. There's no car in our family. So my mate said, oh, you've got to come and see Mole Famau, which is the local big mountain up there. And I said, I'll do it. He says, we go Sundays with this cycling club. I said, I'm not coming Sundays. It's the only day Mum cooks a hot meal for me, Sunday lunch. And so I didn't go for a while. Then I did. He persuaded me. And then I saw guys that were dressed like pros, and I just wanted to be one of them. I found I was okay on a bike. I was sure, like everybody else, I came home in tears sometimes because we rode miles through those Welsh mountains. But it was an achievement. And I just got the bait, and I wanted to be a pro bike rider. I remember going in the school period when we did our physical education. The master of the day used to come up to me and say, Liggett, you are useless. Just get out of my sight. That was because I didn't want to do anything in the, like climb a wall bar, jump over a vaulting horse, do anything. So he said, in the end, he said, just take your bike and go for a ride and come back. And that's exactly what I did. And at the end of my time at school, I remember him coming up to me and he said, Liggett, he said, I've read all about you in the local papers riding your bike. He says, one day I'll see you in the Tour de France. And that was our last conversation we ever had. And of course, I wonder if he ever realized, yes, he did see me in the Tour de France, but over the 47 times I've been to the Tour de France, it was never as a cyclist. There you are. So that's how I started. And I got bitten by the bug. And I followed my nose. I joined a famous club called the North Wirral Velo, which had a lot of riders who'd ridden for England. There was no room for me climbing. I was 17 years of age. Last month of me being 17, I rode one race. I finished second to last. Would have been last, but the guy in front punctured 50 meters from the finish. And on that circuit, it was in Staffordshire, I swore from that very day onwards, wherever I went as a bike rider, I'd never ride that circuit again, and I never did. But it was so hard to climb up to the finish. Anyway, I once I turned 18, I was automatically a senior rider, and you get the lowest level of license, which in those days was third category. And I progressed to the international level within two seasons, to first category. Mm-hmm. And then I had to leave the club I was in. There was no room for me at the top. Those guys were good, but they gave me a lot of good tips. One or two of them rode the Tour de France in 1967. And, I just moved on to clubs up in the north. I came south as a journalist in 67. I joined the Southern Club. I won my first race for the Southern Club. And I just carried on, and I followed my nose. I didn't think it was ever good. I had no ambition to be a commentator or a radio broadcaster or indeed a journalist at the time, although I was writing. And in 66, I had a pro contract on the table after a year in Belgium. And at the same time, a magazine from London rang me and said, "Hey, there's a vacancy here." I'd done some work for them all year to make some pennies reporting local bike races in Belgium. Well, there were big bike races. Tommy Simpson was the world champion at the time. And they said, "We like what you do. Come down for an interview." So over the winter, I went for the interview. I didn't get the job. Just before I was going to return to Belgium, turn pro and all that, they rang me up and says, "The guy who got the job left you." This was Friday lunchtime. "If you're at the desk in Fleet Street, 8 a.m. Monday morning, then we know you want the job." I had no decision to make. I didn't know what to do. I remember going home that night on the Friday saying to Mum, "I think I'm going to live in London, Mum." And of course, a northerner and a southerner to this day don't really like each other. And Mum said, "What are you going down there for?" I said, "Well, I'll be back." I said, "I'm just going down probably for the week, but they've offered me a job to train as a journalist." I went, and I'm still down here. I'm still in London now. I've never been back. And poor Mum's no longer with us. She was my strength too. But there we are. I became a journalist. The editor said, "You can't race. I know you're racing," he said, "but you've got to stop that now. You're going to be a journalist. You're going to report the races." And I thought in my mind, yeah, right. So I didn't stop racing. And he turned a blind eye. He became a personal friend, the editor, after a short while. And he called me over after about 6 months because he'd been getting nice letters at the magazine saying, "Hey, it's great to see the magazine's got a racing cyclist on his staff at last, somebody who can ride a bike." And he told me, obviously, "Look, I told you you couldn't race, and I said nothing. So I'm going to change the rules now. If you're late on a Sunday night," but we had to always work Sunday nights to put the paper to bed Monday morning, so we had to type up all the race reports and results at night, Sunday. And he said, "If you're late," he said, "I'll sack you." And he would have done, too. Even though we became the close event, he would have sacked me. And he said, "Oh, and another rule." I said, "What's that, Alan?" He said, "You can only ride the top event of the weekend because I don't want you writing about chippers, which is a rough race, small races which you can win." Okay. And so I was riding the big races. Of course, I was coming back absolutely knackered and working till midnight and back in the office at 6 a.m. to get the paper off to the printers. But I lasted 2 years and I did a few nice things. He made me select a British record, which he thought I could get. He gave me a day a week off to train with expenses to buy enough Mars bars. And I broke the record. And then he made me write three pages in the magazine on. The headline was, "Record breaking is easy." To this day, I'll vouch it wasn't. I sat on the floor of the car park for 2 hours, being sick into a bucket after I broke that record.
What was that record, Phil? What was the record you broke?
Called Winchester to Wantage and back down in Hampshire. I think it was the statue at each end is King Henry, I think, one of the King Henrys. And they're both in those two towns. And so you've got to put them between. You can start and finish where you like as long as you turn at both those statues. It was 80 miles and it was bloody hilly. And 5 miles to go, I was 10 minutes up on the record. I finished 1 minute 20 to the good and I hit the wall like you would never believe. Never believe. But the record stood for 10 years, and the guy who broke it was extremely good, many more light years ahead of me on talent, guy by the name of John Woodburn. And they thought it would be a good idea if I presented him with his record-breaking certificates, which I did at a dinner. And I said, "John, why did you wait 10 years to break this record?" I said, because you're such a good bike rider. He just said to me, my age, he said, because it was a bloody good record you got, he said, and it wasn't easy. I was very flattered.
Isn't that great? Yeah, you know, I think it's one thing to transition from maybe somewhat of a dream to ride in the Tour de France, and I can imagine kind of having the pro tour license there and everything else, and that transition to go, no, I'm going to write and be a journalist, and eventually.
I was very, very lucky. Trish, my wife, always says I was born with, well, Mum used to say I had a halo over my head. Trish just thought I was just so conceited because everything I said used to happen in my career. And do you know, Greg, I've never asked for a job in my life. Apart from the original job at Cycling Magazine, I applied for it and eventually got it. Television have come to me, radio always come to me, and my newspapers I used to write for national papers, they all asked me to work for them. I've been so incredibly lucky and grateful. Never forget, I'm extremely grateful. I turned my hobby into a way of life. I make no bones about it. I made a lot of money from the business, but I got more than that. I've had a terrific lot of satisfaction and made worldwide friends, nice people. I always have said, you don't meet a bad person in the sports. They're all good. They've all got ambition, and they can be a little bit ugly at times, but they're all nice people.
I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, both my wife, Laura, and I always talking about how grateful we are to have experienced sport. And one of the ways she phrases it is, you know, we got to experience life using the sport of triathlon as the tool, as the way to see the world, meet people, learn more about ourselves as, you know, on the physical, mental, and emotional level. And I think sport is such a great avenue to be able to experience and learn life's lessons. You know, it's not always rosy. You know, there's tough days and but I think from everything you've just said, I think the underlying thing that drives you and that you've had in your DNA is this unbelievable passion, whether it be riding the bike or talking about those that are riding the bikes in races. I think there's this passion of yours is just so contagious that it's hard not to listen to your voice and get excited about what you're excited about. You know, and I think that's been your greatest gift. And I guess when it comes to preparing for these events over the last 50 years plus, how have you done your research? I mean, are you scripting anything? I mean, some of your quotes for people that don't know, I love the one, you know, and so the first pedal of anger, the first pedal has been turned in anger, or once you pull on that golden fleece, you become two men, or his legs have turned to rubber and his effort reduced to a mere survival, or dancing on the pedals.
No way.
They just come to you.
Yeah. I look at the television screen, I see a picture. I remember one particular time, Paris-Roubaix, the riders were racing over a really nasty cobbled section. They're in a straight line, dust was everywhere. And it just fell out my mouth. I said, they're on a roller coaster of pain, because that's what it appeared to be like. And I mean, when I worked with CBS, they loved all that. But I didn't go to the commentary position with a bag full of phrases, never. Sometimes I've walked away from the TV and said, did I really say that? Sharing, because I was never going to say it until it came out of my mouth, and to this day it remains the same. But I'm very grateful it happens. I mean, there is a book written about my ligatisms, as they call them. And I look at it and I think, I'm sure I couldn't have said some of this stuff, but obviously the guy that wrote it did find all the old tapes. He went through it meticulously and took down every blinking phrase I'd ever done. Some are stuck. I mean, they used to have Phil and Paul bingo, wondering when we're going to say the phrase, and they cross the phrase off the bingo card. That is quite popular on the internet. Can you believe I'm wearing the T-shirt at the moment, sleeping in bed, and it's got Phil and Paul bingo on the chest, and all the phrases I've said, I use it as my pajamas. Anyway, I find it quite amazing that. Well, the biggest important thing is I've entertained people. In the earlier you mentioned about my research. Well, research when I started 78 through to the early to mid 80s, there was no internet to go and chase everything through. We were in dire straits. I mean, I used to do voiceovers for ITV in 1978, 79, and 80 in London or wherever I was near a studio in Britain. And I would walk to the studio and they'd give me 20 minutes of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. No list of riders and no information of where they are on the course, and no course route at all. And it was a nightmare. For 2 years, I really dreaded doing these voiceovers. And then one day I woke up and thought, I love this television business, and I got stuck in. But nowadays, it's a gift. You want the start list, press start list on your computer. A list of riders and so on and so forth. Since 78, I've built my own records as far as riders are concerned, and I have the most enviable system which I use, and that's, I won't share it with anyone. I used to give Paul a copy, other people have asked me, and I say, well, bugger off. I said, that's my whole life's there, and I spent my whole life doing it. I'm not going to give it to you. You might be better than me, and then I'll be out of a job. And so, that's happened. But even though we're stuck down and there's hardly any racing, there's been one or two races, including the Slovakian Championship or Slovenian Championship. So I've logged all those results already, and I've logged one or two situations of riders who've crashed training during this business. I've put that down on the records too, so that when we do start, I'll be able to remember what they did and what they how they injured themselves, etc., etc. No, it's easy now as far as that's concerned. So people say, how early do you start prepping for the Tour de France? And the answer is the day before the race starts. I look at the route, and I'm always reading about it, but I'm not writing notes because I've got every rider's reputation at a flick of their name on my computer. So I don't worry too much about that. It's the other stories you want, like we used to boost up the castles of the chateau, for example, on the tour. That's what people want to hear about. And my favorite phrase is to Paul Sherwin, I say, look, Paul, we in our heyday on the Tour de France, working for just about every English-speaking network, including working for the Tour de France, who sent our pictures to a lot of millions of people, we estimated 150 million viewers a day. And I used to say to Paul, there ain't that many cyclists in the world, mate. So let's keep those others happy. The cyclists will understand the sport and they can always turn our sound off. And so we started telling them other things about the Tour de France, stories and about the villages, the towns, the birds, and so on. And I said, because what you've got to do, Paul, as the not all cyclists watching our show, is to stop the old lady going to make a cup of tea until the commercial break. And so that's what we do.
I love that. I love that. And you know, I can't tell you how many friends I have that tune in, like I said at the top of the show. My mum, she doesn't know anything about cycling.
Yeah, I like to hear that.
That's it. They want to hear the chateaus and the wine and the cheese and all the bird life. They get their tour around France, and it's almost the cycling is the backdrop, you know, for them.
Well, it's very important. I used to get lots of mail from people saying, can you give us the route of the Tour de France? And they weren't cyclists. They wanted to know where the route went so they could go on their summer holidays after the race is finished, because they knew the route would be through some of the most beautiful roads and towns that France had on offer, places where they'd never think of driving to. And it's true. Then they watch the race, see where it goes, and then choose where they're going to go and have the holidays. It happens. And I don't blame them. I think I might do the same. But what happened when the tour got so popular, and a lot of it was due to the way we were selling it, I'm convinced the organization changed the whole attitude. First of all, they were very nice to me and Paul. And then they helped, and then they provided much more information away from cycling. And so that was what really made it very important to us all. Then if you notice, the swing moved. The Tour of Spain started doing it. The Tour of Italy started doing it. And then they were selling it to the people, to the governments. This is a shop window for our country. Help us out here. And they got much more support.
Isn't that amazing that you guys were a large part of the catalyst for that kind of way of thinking, that they actually saw what you were doing and the changes that you could do by using the cycling as the backdrop, but the way they could show their countries, and that yourself and Paul were ahead of your time in what people wanted. And I love that you did the math, you know, 150 million, there's not that many cyclists. And so you've stepped back and gone, hang on, we're talking to more than just cyclists here. We got to make sure we're offering them more. I think that's just fascinating. And just you're ahead of your time with that kind of thinking. It's just brilliant.
Well, I could say that I'm very untechnical, therefore I have to think of something else to say. Tell me about what in those days was a 28-spoke wheel or a tyre or whatever. I used to always leave that technical stuff to Paul. I mean, it didn't hold a lot of interest for me. I'm just not an engineer type person. I'm just a wordsmith, if you like. But So whenever I got a problem I couldn't work out, I'd say, Paul, what's he talking about? And then Paul would say, well, Phil, you know, so-and-so, so-and-so, the bikes are made now from carbon fiber. Really? And off we went again. You know.
I know, you guys together, honestly, I want to definitely discuss a lot more with your relationship a little bit later in the show. Did you ever get nervous? Has there ever been a particular, like you mentioned the first day of the tour, it's kind of nice to get that first sprint out of the way, but did you ever get nervous interviewing somebody, or did you ever have butterflies before a particular event, or did you sort of, were you pretty relaxed with all of that?
I don't get nervous when I'm doing an interview. I'm all ready for that. And usually the person I'm interviewing is probably more nervous than me because that's a set up position. But to go on air live, first of all, that is the best television. And I started out with a live broadcast in April 1978. And I remember the head of sport telling me at the time when they gave me the job, he said, right, well, you're going to learn the hard way, he says, because in 4 weeks' time, we're doing a live broadcast of a professional race from Crystal Palace in London. Well, I said, I know all about that. I'm the organizer, as it happened. I was. And I brought 88 pros, highest pro field ever to take part in a race in Britain, except for the World Championships in Britain. And I had Bernard Thévenet, who by then had won the Tour twice. I had Barry Hoban, who was our big number one boy from the Tour de France. Paul Sherwin, riding his first race back home as a pro in 1978. Mm-hmm. And a lot of pros turned up. Jerry Kennettman, who was the current world champion, etc. And, you know, when I went to the nobody tells you how to be a commentator, or as I told you just now, I'm not technical. I went up into the commentary box, which was 80 feet up a pylon. They'd built it halfway up a pylon so I could see life around me and start the race because I was still the organizer. I climbed up there, and then the floor manager climbed up behind me, come in and said, right, he said, are you all okay, everything here you need? I said, well, I don't know. Why not? He said, this is my first job. Oh, you've not done it before? I said, no. Oh, my goodness. Right, he says. Well, you've got two televisions here. We don't call them televisions, he said. They're monitors. Now, when the pictures match on them both, you're live. Otherwise, you'll just have Crystal Palace and the studio pictures, whatever's going out on TV. I said, okay. He said, if you want to cough without the public hearing you, press that button there. Or swear, same button. Other than that, he said, have a good day. And yeah, I disappeared, never saw him again. And so then I remember then the guy fronting up the program, which was called ITV's World of Sport. It was a brilliantly watched program on Saturday afternoons. And my insert was 45 minutes of this bike race. And so the guy's name was Dickie Davis. And Dickie called me on my landline phone by the television monitor. No mobiles, of course, in those days. And I picked the phone up. I go, hello. And he goes, hello, old son. Dickie called everybody old son. And I said, Dickie. He goes, yes, talking to me. I can't believe it. This guy's a superstar on TV. And he said, look, he said, I'm going to give you a big build-up when we go to the ad break. We were doing professional wrestling at the time, so the monitor was showing wrestling. The left-hand monitor was showing Crystal Palace. Dickie's on the phone. When we go to the ad break, I'll give you a big build-up. When we come back, he said, enjoy it. Just remember why you got the job. I said, Dickie, that's the trouble. I don't know why I got the job. He said, just be yourself and don't change when you go on television. That's the best and only advice anybody ever gave me. And I passed it on to Paul Sherwin, and I took Paul on board in the early 80s. And so I'm watching the TV. I saw the right-hand monitor go to black because that was the actual show. All the riders were now on the start line on my left-hand monitor waiting for the cue from me, thumb out the window because I was still starting the race as well as commentating. And then the picture came up. I saw a nice shot of both Crystal Palace, both monitors. And then I heard Dickie Davis in my earphones saying, well, we're going over to Crystal Palace now. He said, one of the biggest fields ever assembled in Great Britain, and the two-time winner of the Tour de France, the Frenchman Bernard Thévenet, and the world champion Jerry Kitten are both there, and so is our commentator, Phil Liggett. I was just watching the telly. I didn't say anything. And then I heard my producer on the ground said, Liggett, cue commentator. And I just was mesmerized by the pictures. I never said a word. He goes, cue commentator. The next thing he said was, for fuck's sake, Liggett, I mean you. And he shouted into my cans. I nearly leapt through the commentary box window. I stuck my thumb out the window, which started the race. I stammered to a good afternoon and welcome to Crystal Palace. And then I got stuck in and tried and followed. I thought it was crap. They asked me how they thought they'd done when I came off. And I said, oh, I don't know. But I thought it was crap. I mean, I said, now he got the world champion Jerry Kinnettman breaking wind at the front when he got out into the breakaway. And oh, dear me.
But, breaking wind at the front.
Yeah, I just loved the job at the end. But live television from that moment on became my favorite. And if you're not nervous before you go live, then get out, because you've got to be just like you're riding a bike race or starting a triathlon. You've got to feel it in your body. Let's go. Let's unleash the demon in us now. The first 2 minutes are settling in time. With American TV, it's much more difficult because they're much more controlled. But I used to, when CBS used to, I used to get these little personal assistants come up just before I would start on air. And she goes, excuse me, Mr. Liggett, can you tell me what your first words will be, please, for the producer? I look at her.
Oh, dear.
And I say, well, I've no idea. I said, probably hello. And then I heard in a little radio thing, he says, oh, leave him alone, he's a Brit. And that was it. So they accepted. I never knew what my first words were going to be because I script nothing. Yeah. But I make notes and in my brain. And so I hope I get them in the right order.
Yeah, I've heard that you have would you say you have a bit of a photographic memory?
Yeah, I believe that I do have a photographic memory, and I see things in that picture. And that's when all my phrases come to me because of that. You know, when I travel in cars when I go out with friends for a drink or when I'm on location, and I start commentating in the car. I never think about it. I go, look at that guy crossing the road now. His hat's on one side of his head. He's not going to make this before that. And then suddenly I've seen the driver turn around. I said, hey, you're a commentator. I can tell that now, mate. I suddenly realized, Christ, it's true. I do it even to this day when I go to the pub with my wife. I start commentating on the cars coming the other way or something. So there we are. It's what I do.
I love it. Just a quick mini break before we get back to the show. I just want to remind you guys to go check out athleticgreens.com/Greg. Sign up and get your free 20 daily travel packets with your first order of $79 added value. That's athleticgreens.com/Greg. I have some similar stories with the commentary. I've always been a strong visualizer as an athlete. I've always visualized, you know, when I'm out training and I have the commentator in my head almost, you know, and the helicopter's flying above and the athletes around me, and I create this environment and I just start commentating, you know, it's Greg Bennett and everything's actually, whereas Laura doesn't visualize as easy. And so what we used to do is I'd run with her in her workouts and I would commentate out loud, you know, it'd be like, you know, stand up, America, here comes Laura Bennett into the stadium. You know, we'd get really excited and she would be sprinting. We get to incredible workouts because I enjoyed that kind of commentary as well. And maybe that's why I'm such a big fan of yours as well. I kind of love the energy of a commentator. I love the passion. And for me, that's always kind of been within myself in that kind of, I just enjoy that kind of celebration that a commentator brings to an event. But I guess that leads me into this next little era, mm-hmm. which you go for 3.5 weeks on these grand tours. I mean, particularly the Tour de France. Yeah. How do you sustain it? How are you able to pace yourself throughout and not burn out? And have you had any experiences where you have lost your voice or you have had?
Yes, I've had a couple of occasions when I have lost my voice. I remember once the voice just went. Thankfully, it doesn't go very often, but on this occasion, I remember doing a piece to camera for the television at the time saying, well, My voice is going, well, I can assure you I'm not abandoning the tour, so stay with me for the next 5 days to Paris. And I said something like that to the camera. It sometimes does happen, thankfully, very almost never, but it has happened, yeah. You catch a cold or something like that. I've always found that actually the television's been very, very kind to me when these things have happened. They've nursed me and got me to lay down in the car while they get me a driver and get me pills and stuff to get me back on the road again, plenty of warm drinks, because I'm not a pill taker. I'm a great believer in natural medicine. I'll get better, the body will take over, the immune system will kick in. I just don't take pills. But these guys are anxious to get me back on the telly. I never came off. I've never actually come off. If it got really bad, I couldn't get to the high pitches of the commentary, I would tell Sherwin, you're going to take the race to the finish, because if I shout, my voice will go off the scale and it'll disappear. Yeah.
but you've managed, I mean, these tours, what I love about the Tour de France is the fact, obviously, that it's moving around the entire country, and it's the circus goes all together and you all travel. And I mean, they're long days. Yeah. You're traveling thousands and thousands of kilometers. How are you able to actually recover, prepare, get ready for the next day? How are you actually able to, I mean, like an athlete kind of has a whole team around them of experts that are getting their body ready. They got all the, I mean, these days compared to probably, you know, well, you can tell me about it, but basically in the olden days, their recovery is getting so much better between stages. But how are you doing it and able to keep turning up?
It's a very good point you're making, Greg. Because a routine day for us, we get up at 6:30 every day. We go to that, to wherever the start is by 9 a.m., the finish line rather, by 9 a.m. We prep the programs. And remember, I was working often for three or four different television stations for a lot of my career. So I do three or four different openings. And then we go on air about 2 in the afternoon. We come off around 5:30. And then we get in the car. We drive to the next finish, which can be anything up to 200 plus kilometers away. We wouldn't take the race route. We'd take the auto route. So it's a long day. We often arrive at the hotel between 10:30 and midnight, and we'd have asked the people who own the hotel to leave us some cold food out and a bottle of wine. And we had to get about 1 o'clock. But the routine was we weren't wearing ourselves out. I get more and more calmer if the world around me starts to panic, which is great. Because that's where all your energy is. When you start to panic, your nervous energy makes you completely shattered. So if I hear the producer panicking because he's on the deadline, his camera's not working, I just sit there waiting. I'm not bothered. And I managed to get Paul to act the same way as me. And we don't burn the candle at both ends. When we have the chance, we go to bed early. And if we get, you know, we didn't burn the candle at both ends. We used to pace ourselves. Because I remember in Berlin in 86, we had a new producer for independent television in England. And he was so excited to be producing the Tour de France and managing me and Paul. Everything was new to him. Everything he saw. The tour is huge. These people are spread over hundreds and hundreds of kilometers every night. And he had all these ideas to get this interview, get that interview. There's so-and-so over there, go and do it now while he's doing nothing. And I said, Rod, I said, you've got to calm down, mate. This is Sunday. The tour started yesterday. 4 Sundays from now, you'll still be on the same race. So we'll get the guys, but let's just stay a bit cool on this one. And that's exactly what happened. By day 2, he fell asleep into his soup and he passed out. He was knackered. And the reason this story sticks in my mind is because I leaned over, I took his wallet out of his pocket, took the money and gave it to the waiter, put the receipt back in his wallet and put it back in because he thought he hadn't paid the bill because he fell asleep. So I made sure he paid the bill and claimed it back so I didn't pay it. And that's an absolutely true story. And sadly, Rod's no longer with us, but he was just wanting to interview everybody that moved. There's Felix Leveson, let's go over now. Let's leave until tomorrow, and he's calmer, and so on and so forth, yeah. Because there's so many stories to do. Of course, these days it's almost luxury now because NBC have a big crew, we have a studio set up. I'm purely a commentator, and I've got a co-commentator in Bob Rowell. The others, we have interviewers, guys will interview the riders. We have reporters at the start line, 200K from where we're sat, who's interviewing riders. It's a piece of cake now. All I do is 5 minutes, ad break, another 5 minutes, ad break. It's all too easy now.
I was going to actually, I wanted just to discuss a bit about your team and you know, obviously Paul Sherwin, who we all dearly miss, but I don't think anybody probably misses him as much as yourself and his wife.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about going to bed and having a bottle of wine. And I read in preparation for this, and I heard that you guys were such close friends that you were basically brothers, and that you would often go to bed, you know, laughing your heads off and telling stories, not always about cycling, or actually quite often not about cycling, but you guys were so close that, you know, and 33 years you guys sat together.
Yeah.
And I think, and excuse me if I'm wrong, but I think that's probably the longest duo commentary team in the history of television and sport. Just tell me a bit about
your... He was very proud of that fact. He used to remind me. I said, well, just remember how old we are then. Shut up.
Yeah. But I think, you know, you can't be who you are without an incredible team. You've mentioned your wife, Trish, and obviously Paul. Tell me a bit about the team that you had sort of starting out, and you know, and you mentioned your mum, but tell me about the team that's starting out compared to what it is like now with NBC. Like you said, it's such a big production now, and how that's all changed.
Well, in the early days, the very first live coverage we did of the Tour de France, which if memory serves right, is 1983. It could have been 84. I travelled to France as normal by myself. God, I didn't have a co-commentator then. And to do the weekend shows for ITV's World of Sport, which the people who gave me my first job. But then, as I was leaving on the Thursday before the tour, the producer of ITV's World of Sport said, oh, and by the way, Metters, now Metters was an Olympic silver medalist in the 4x400 relay. Adrian Metcalf, he won a silver medal in 72 in Munich. And he had taken a love to cycling. And earlier at the 80 Olympics, he'd said to me over dinner one night, he said, Phil, I think your sport's fantastic. He says, and I'm going to tell you now, next year there's a new television channel starting called Channel 4. And I have been appointed the commissioning editor for sport. I said, that's brilliant, Metters. Well done. He says, now look, I want to pay you £200 a year to get all the letters that all these crazy cyclists write to me to tell me why their race should be on television. I'm going to send all those letters to you. You send the ones back I should read. And he paid me £200 a year for that. So that's what happened in 82. Now, all of a sudden, I went into the office of 83 or 84, I think it was 83, and the head of sport for ITV said to me, by the way, he said, Metters has been in. He says he's going to cover the Tour de France live every day. But don't worry, he won't do it. And it's a mammoth undertaking. And so I said to, I went to France with just that one word, it might happen. Well, anyway, I got to France on the Thursday. The race start on the Saturday. Saturday's a big day for the World of Sport program. I can a lot for them live as well. And then they come on and say, oh, now, Metcalf is actually going to do the tour live every day. So you need to be in position so much before the race starts. He's just going to cover what's offered, which in those days is the last 2 hours of the race or so. And I had to produce, direct, and do everything else because there was nobody else out there, only me. And we used the host cameras, etc. And so there was a producer in London, or a mixer director in London. He would be in my earphones. He said, right, Phil, he said, we're going live in a minute. 1 minute. I said, okay. He said, our first pictures will be a general view of France. Right. After that, we'll show the overall standing in the race and then go for it. Okay. So he would say, right, you're on. And I would just immediately say, well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the route to Tour de France. I'm Phil Liggett, and this is stage number 2. And we're going to Fred Blocks to so-and-so. After yesterday's stage, the overall situation is, and he was putting the pictures in, which I never saw back in London. And then I just picked up commentary and called it all the way through. And after the finish, we did the ending, and he said, "I've got the overall result on the screen now. Put the overall result on. We're just cutting in an interview which was being offered by the host. I didn't see it." And so we did that. This went on for a whole 3 weeks, and they got, it was a brand new channel, and they got the maximum viewers they could record, which gave them the courage to go forward. It was 200,000 viewers per day. It really caught the imagination back in the UK. The new network was over the moon. They had something that was special. Nobody else had done it live at all ever in the history of the tour on British television. So the following year, I had a phone call from a guy called Brian Venner, who had his own production company and was the former head of BBC Sports Television. And I'd never heard of him. Anyway, he came on the phone. He said, "My name is Brian Venner." I said, "Hello. How can I help you?" He says, "Well, I've no idea who you are," he says, "but I'm told I've got to employ you." I said, "What?" He said, "I'm doing the Tour de France every day for Channel 4 next year, and apparently you can commentate on it." I said, "Wow." And then we met. We became lifelong friends. Brian's a wonderful character, did many, many races together. He's still around, but I just don't work for them anymore. And that's how it all started. That was life on television. Then Brian came, and it was a whole different ballgame. We had a production team out there. We had people doing things. I couldn't understand people bringing me tea to the Comedy Box. I used to go and get my own. Life was changed, and that was the start of the Tour de France in really big, big ways, and it's never lost its popularity.
When you look at cycling now, how would you describe the world of cycling now? Say, let's talk pre-corona, because I think at the moment the whole world is uncertain. So let's talk pre-corona. Yeah. The state of cycling worldwide, I think it's in a pretty healthy place. Would you agree?
Yes, it's become so popular around the world, and there's coverage everywhere now. Sometimes I question just the amount of coverage. I mean, I don't think it's a great idea showing a boring stage of the Tour de France from the minute the flag drops to the minute the riders cross the line. It's just a waste of airtime, as far as I'm concerned. It does show the country off well, but a poor old commentator has to really work hard to make it interesting. And most people can't do that because they only know about cycling. But that's the way it is. In my days, right through until the last, 15 years, it's been a great adventure, because things go wrong. Nothing was pure and perfect. We used to lose pictures. I commentated on the finish of a race into Blagnac on the Tour de France with no pictures, and I called the winner. the infamous Brian Venner was on a telephone from London telling me what was in the picture. And he said, "These men in blue are racing, and it's about a kilometre to go." Well, I suddenly realised it's the Panasonic team, and they're trying to lead out somebody like Phil Anderson, whatever it was at the time, or whatever. And I was doing it to such good perfection. The other television company, we'd lost all our pictures in the race because of a rainstorm in Blagnac, but everybody around the world had perfect pictures. So I was commentating. All the commentators came to my thinking my TV was working because I was looking at it, but there's nothing there. But I saw out my side of my eye, Paul took them away and said, "Hey, the guy in London's telling me what the pictures are." "Oh, okay." Because they cancelled everything around the world. They weren't commentating. Brian made me commentate on nothing, and I got the winner right as well. He was very gracious. He came on afterwards and said, "I've got to tell you, Phil, that is probably one of the best commentaries I've ever heard from you." He said, "You're totally perfect, and I don't know anybody else that could have done it without bloody pictures." And I said, "Because you're such a good descriptionist, Brian, you told me perfectly exactly what was happening," which he wasn't.
That is true.
Yeah, but those days were exciting. Nowadays, even the racing's a bit automated, and I don't like breakaway goes, breakaway caught, somebody wins. And that is the sole reason I don't like riders with radios. I want to see a little bit of human input as well.
Couldn't agree more. I think we want to see the brakes be able to get away. I mean, you've illustrated with a lot of humor some of the crazy things behind the scenes. Are there any other kind of things that have stood out where, you know, things have happened that maybe as viewers we wouldn't know, or any sort of things where, I mean, I mean, not always funny. I'm sure there's some that are quite scary. Any kind of stories that you have there?
Nothing jumps to my mind. But Sherwin was quite funny when Paul Sherwin fell off his chair when he was describing a castle outside on the television. And his chair just broke under him. And I looked left and I had to look right again because he sits on my left because he was in a mess upside down and still commentating. Because apart from a bump and a bang, you had no idea. His voice didn't change. But I was dying to laugh. It was a ridiculous situation. But he never told anybody. He pulled it round and he got back up. And while I took the microphone commentary, he got back up and positioned himself again. It was hilariously funny. But things do go wrong that the viewers don't hear. And then the commentators, the producers start panicking in your ear and shouting and swearing at you. Not that it's my fault, but they're trying to get the thing put right. I remember doing a tour of Ireland once, and the producer was prone to four-letter words anyway. But when he wasn't getting live pictures over Dublin, and we were commentating from the Irish television studios, he's saying, "Why aren't I getting any effing booby pictures?" And that was because the helicopter pilot was still outside the window having a cigarette he hadn't taken off. And then I saw him, he obviously heard the comedy, I saw him stop out the fag and he jumped into his chopper, set it going and got in the air. And we met, I was commentating with a great icon in Irish commentary, a guy called Jimmy McGee, who they call the memory man because he was simply brilliant. And Jimmy says, "Oh, now," he says, "Michael," he says, "the helicopter was a little bit slow getting away, but he's up in the air now. You should have your pictures any second." And then he was saying, "Well, bloody time," and whatever happened. But those things were not known to the viewers. It was hilariously funny, though. We were in tears.
Yeah. That's brilliant. And it hasn't always been smooth sailing. I mean, the Tour de France specifically has had its moments over the 47 years. Are there any kind of moments in the tour where you're like, "Oh, this, you know, this could be the end of this tour, or this could be the end of the Tour de France"? Were there any things that stood out?
Throughout my 47 years, I think the tour's seen every aspect of its problems, and it's probably because it's become one of the biggest sporting events in the world, and it's going to be a target for every idiot in the world. Consequently, the Basque separatists have blew us up a couple of times, and they only just missed us too. In San Luis Sulon, they blew up a garage right next to our hotel. And they blew up the post office in Andorra. I just walked out the darn post office to buy a stamp and the damn thing blew up. So I was very lucky in that respect. We had the Basque separatists in Spain put an incendiary device under my car, blew it to smithereens and everything else in it. The good news was Sherwin had 50 DVDs in there, which were crap. I didn't like any of his music. And we all melted. But apart from that, it was a very serious situation.
That's funny, though.
It was funny. When that blew up, it was at midnight, and I'd just gone to bed, and I was in bed, and the cameraman was knocking on my door. No, it was the sound man was knocking on the door saying, Phil, your car's on fire. I'm not joking, your car's on fire. I said, "Yeah, right. Well, I've got no clothes on. Good night." And he said, no, we're not joking. And, of course, I went out, and the car had rolled into the foyer of the hotel. The hotel was on fire, and it became very serious. In fact, Mick Jagger... next day, because I was a friend indirectly through Mick Jagger, he'd written a foreword for a book I wrote, and my mate was his manager. And Mick actually contacted me and offered me his makeup artist and his clothes, his wardrobe, because we had no clothes, they were all burned. And I said, "Mick, with the best of wishes to you, there's no way your clothes are going to make me look any good." He left it because the race actually that year was going past his French home in Blois. And he was a cycling nut. That's how I came to meet him. So that's another aside. But as for the separatists and the strikers, we had the race stopped at Denain once, the steel workers, and because it made a big impression. And we had the team time trial cancelled, which was a great tragedy for the tour. And the strikers actually didn't do themselves any favours because the French public were very much anti that sort of thing, damaging the image of the tour. Then we had the era of all the drug taking, of course, started with Festina back in 98. And then you just didn't know who to trust anymore. And that was a nasty period of time. The Lance Armstrong saga, which Lance was a very special athlete, and I don't care what you say, pills do not make thoroughbred out of a donkey. So you've got to be a thoroughbred to start with. And Lance was racing against guys who were also taking drugs. But, you know, you can debate this forevermore. But at the end of the day, he did bring to the table many, many more viewers, especially from the States. Thousands, tens of thousands of viewers. Our figures went through the roof. So did the French television's figures. And it was all because of Lance's participation. And even though Lance left the sport, those people who discovered it didn't. And they found a new way of life. So there is always good from bad.
No, I agree with everything you said there. And I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the tour, since it started in 1903, there's so many stories that come out of it. And one of the real joys I had in preparing to chat with you today was simply reading and looking at some of the old footage and some of the crazy stories that came out from the cheating in 1904. And I mean, look, it's a grand spectacle. Things are going to happen. And I think that's what makes the Tour de France such an adventure for all of us. The reason you tune in every July is because you don't know what's going to happen. There is always something unique, whether it's on the race course or outside of the race course, that makes it a special July. And you've been there for so many of them, telling these stories. And I just think
I was there for the first one in 1903, but I wasn't, honest. We started in 1973, which is the 60th Tour de France in 73. But you're right. The challenge was there to start with. In 1902, when it should have been held, they couldn't get an entry because the challenge was too great. They got the entry of just about 60 or 70 riders in 1903. It became a challenge. And in 1904, you're right, there was a wholesale cheating, people sitting in trains or getting ways round the route without riding it. That was in the July. They didn't disqualify the first three riders in the race till November that year. And so the youngest winner, Henri Cornet, I think he was 18, was announced the winner in November of that year. And from that moment on, Henri de Grange, first of all, said, that's it, nobody's going to abuse the race like this, we're going to stop it. Of course they didn't, and how many times now have I heard old organisers say, that's it, we're not having a tour next year.
I even think it's funny when we say, you know, we talk about the drug era, and yet you go back to 1924 when the two brothers, you probably know their name, Charles and Henry, is it Pellissier?
Pellissier.
John. Yeah, and they said, look, we're not racing anymore because we don't want to be on the strychnine, cocaine, chloroform and aspirin, whatever they were taking, and horse ointments and all sorts of things. I mean, that was 1924.
Exactly.
So I don't, you know, drugs in sport, it's not a new thing. I think you're always going to have people trying to outdo each other. It's just an incredible kind of – let's talk specifically about some of your favorite things in the Tour de France, because it is the Tour de France that is the kind of the light of cycling to some degree. If I asked you your favorite moment in the Tour de France, what would you say it is?
Well, my favorite tour was 89, and I guess my favorite moment was the last 200 meters of that race, when Greg LeMond beat Laurent Fignon in the time trial to win the tour by 8 seconds, because earlier in the day, I'd predicted Greg would turn the tables and win the race by 6 seconds live on TV. But it was recorded, but I couldn't stop it going out. And when I said at the end, Paul called it perfectly with me that day, the gain of LeMond, I think it was 1.2 seconds a kilometre, he was doing it. He came down the Champs-Élysées, put his time on the board. Next man down was the last rider to finish, was Fignon, because he was the race leader. And Fignon got 200 metres to go and his time expired. It took him 8 seconds to get to the finish line. And I said, I don't believe this, but Greg LeMond has just won the Tour de France by 8 seconds. LeMond was jumping for joy with Cathy in front of me. Fignon was collapsed on the ground to my right, crying his heart out. And I was in tears because the inimitable Brian Venner put the key over in London and said, next time, Liggett, get it bloody right. Because I predicted 6 seconds, you see, live on TV. And so I burst into tears. So all three of us were crying. It was a crazy moment. But that was a great tour. That was a special tour. With hindsight, 2 days earlier to the tour finishing on the Champs-Élysées, As the riders approached the finish in Aix-en-Provence, the leaders, with the first five riders overall in the Tour de France, all fell off at a roundabout in the rain. They all got up, they crossed the line, and they crossed the line in the future top five finish order of the Tour de France. Greg LeMond won the stage that day, 2 days before the finish, and Laurent Fignon was second, so it went on Delgado, Flavaretta. It was uncanny, but it was only after the race finished we realised that we'd called the GC finish 2 days early. It was a great one.
There was also a really wonderful call for Stephen Roach a couple of years previous. And when he was climbing the hill and you thought he'd been done and dusted. It was before, I think, decent helicopter coverage or whatever else. And
bad producer. We were French.
And your call, I mean, that must be a fond memory when you just suddenly saw Stephen Roach only a few seconds back and that was enough for him to win the Tour de France that year and like you mentioned earlier, the World Championships. All of that in the 1 year.
He got to the Giro. He won the Giro, a little bit of a controversial circumstance because he got the lead. And his teammate Visconti should have won, Vicentini, and of course he was Italian, and so Roach had to stay in his room, have all his meals served in his room. He couldn't sit with the team; everybody hated him. Not least the Italian tifosi, they spit at him and everything. And so he won the Giro, first ever Irishman, and I remember the race started the Tour de France in Berlin. And so we'd driven down the corridor, arrived in Berlin, and I saw Stephen at the start. I said, "Stephen, fantastic ride in the Giro. Well done, mate." "Oh, Phil," he says, "I've won that now." He says, "I can have a holiday this next 3 weeks." He said, "I've got no pressure." And he was serious because he got his big tour win. Anyway, halfway through the tour, he realized he could possibly win. He got bashed by Jean-Francois Bernard on the climb of Mont Ventoux in the time trial. I remember speaking to Stephen that afternoon after he finished. He said, "I lost this time trial, Phil," he says, "but I'll tell you now, the tour isn't finished yet." And he was right. So we came towards the end. Delgado had openly said in the press, by the time they left the Pyrenees, the Alps rather, he needed an advantage over Roach of 2 minutes. Otherwise, he couldn't win the tour in the time trial in Dijon. And on the last stage in those mountains, I think it was the penultimate stage in the mountains, actually, Delgado attacked. And Roach went after him, but we didn't know about this because Fignon was in the lead. I think he was with a rider called Lordolino Cubino. But the two of them were away, climbing into the finish line of La Plagne. And the cameraman was always alongside, obviously, Fignon. But the producers, the director who's pushing the buttons for French television, which we're seeing, was a new guy, and he was only interested in showing the French riders to the French viewers, not the world. The race was behind. The race was between Delgado and Fignon and Roach, but we didn't know. Roach had lost just 2 minutes at the time the climb started. And we got message by semaphore, and we got it, to say that Roach was losing 2 minutes on Delgado at the climb. So we started commentating that this could be the end of Stephen Roach here because he's not with Delgado, who was attacked early. And Delgado knew he had to get those 2 minutes. Oh, what we're doing is watching Fignon climbing nicely. I think he finished fifth in the race overall, but he was going to win the stage. He duly won the stage. Now we had no further news on the proximity of Roach to Delgado. And then as we awaited, Delgado came in third. And then less than 10 seconds behind, two little legs appeared in the top of our 40-centimeter monitor. And they were in the cars and the motorbikes. And Paul Sherwin just didn't say a word. He put his finger to the legs at the top of the picture. And I followed his finger and I just said, "That's Roach. That's Stephen Roach." Because I recognized his legs. We never saw his body. And Roach, I said, "He's right behind him. He's only seconds down." He totally recovered on the climb. He smashed himself. So Roach came right up to the foot of where I was commentating. In those days, they were all there, sort of steel scaffolding and stuff. And he collapsed below in the open air. And I went and looked over at him. I saw his face. They slapped an oxygen mask on him. And eventually they whipped him away. Nobody got to speak to him. And I thought, I was commentating the whole time saying, he's totally exhausted. His life is not in danger, but he's in total distress. And all that came out. And then he disappeared. And so next morning I went and seen Stephen and see if he came to the start. That was the real reason I went. And he looked as sprightly as ever, because Roach's best advantage was his recovery. He could recuperate like no other athlete I ever knew. And he was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I said, Stephen, you okay? He said, oh, Phil, he said, I'm fine. He said, listen, it was hard, it was very hard now. He said, but I didn't want all that business of having to talk to the press after that effort. So he said, I just fell down and let the ambulance take me away. and he got out of all the press interviews and protocol. And he came back and he just did what he had to do in the Dijon time trial and he won.
That was amazing. Anybody that hasn't listened to that commentary, go YouTube it because it is.
All my fans, they just fantastic. They play time and time again. Mm-hmm. I thought they'd be tired about it by now, but they don't. They get the T-shirts and everything. Yeah.
So who do you think would be, I mean, I think I've heard you say you think the greatest cyclist in the world, Eddie Merckx?
It's got to be Eddie. Eddie was my main reason for not taking the Pro Lapco contract, because I was racing with Eddie in his last year as an amateur and I never smelt him. This guy was very, very, very special. We were not friends, didn't know him. He was just a rival, just a guy who popped up and got out of his Mustang car, left his pretty wife inside and went on, won the race and disappeared again. Attacked Eddie. Now we are very good friends, Eddie and I. But I said to him once when I was doing an interview at his home in Brussels, I said, Eddie, do you realize you're the reason I didn't turn professional? He goes, what? His English is okay, but it's quizzical, because Eddie himself is quizzical. He goes, and I said, yeah, I said, because I could never beat you. And he looked at me, he looked at my feet and he walked, his eyes came up my body to my face. He said, you beat me.
I bet.
that's why I never turned professional, Eddie, because you were too good. And I said, you were so boring when you were racing because you always won. And he would look at me and go, yes, well, I had to, because all the public come to see me win, so I must win. And that he was like, fantastic guy.
What about if I asked you, who do you think the most loved cycle? I mean, we have cyclists. We have Peter Sagan these days. Everybody, you know, is drawn to him. Who do you think over the last 47, 50 years, who do you think has been the most loved by the fans?
Yeah, well, my wife, Trish, is shouting Poulidor, and I think she's right, because that was a wonderful period of time. Mm. A man who never wore the maillot jaune. In fact, it's not quite true. He did wear it briefly in a prologue time trial. Then they found out they'd made a mistake in the timings and they went back to his hotel and took it off him. So he didn't wear it, but he did get one. But on the other hand, I think it would have spoiled the wonderful image which he built. He was the working man's real bike rider. He was a farmer. He was a peasant. He had a beautiful caricature face and everybody loved him. All the women, I remember this image years ago. Poulidor sat in the area where the riders sat, not like they do now in buses, and peeling a grapefruit. And this lady, who was a typical French overweight lady dressed in black, was trying to just touch him, leaning across the barrier, going, poo-poo, poo-poo, just wanted to touch him. That was the image he created, and he was a wonderful guy. Sadly, he only died last year now he died. And so he was up against the aristocrat, the Prince of Rouen, Jacques Anquetil, who openly took drugs, by the way, and told everybody, as far as he was concerned, that was his right and he was doing his job. You would take an aspirin to go to work and clear your headache. I'll take strychnine in my legs to ride a bike. And that's the end of it. He wouldn't take any tests. But in those days, they weren't compulsory. Mm-hmm. And so he was the man that they always loved to see beat. But at the end of the day, Anquetil was one of the best bike riders who's ever lived. And people just, only the French know. He has his great book called Jacques Anquetil is the most fantastic read, interpreted from the French. It's beautiful. That guy was special. And Poulidor was the only man that could remotely challenge Jacques. And I'm glad that Raymond never beat him to a yellow jersey because he would never have had the great image he had. Yeah, my wife is right. As usual, it is Poulidor.
I love that story. And again, the homework I did here and looking at Poulidor, you know, the amount of seconds and thirds that he had at the Tour de France, yeah. And he was just always there or thereabouts and one of the most loved people, like you said.
He was fighting second. One day he broke his wrist and he still finished the Tour de France in either second or third place. He rode half the Tour with a plaster cast on his wrist placed on a handlebar. The guy was as tough as nails, but a character. And everybody loved Raymond Poulidor. Everybody, without exception.
What do you think about, I mean, the last 9 years of the Tour de France, 8 of those 9 have been won by non-continental Europe athletes. You know, it's been really quite incredible. Australian, obviously, with Cadel Evans and Brits and Europeans now. I mean, what do you think has been the biggest change? Do you think it's because cycling has become more accepted as a worldwide sport that it's becoming more of that? Or do you think it can continue? And do you think Chris Froome can come back for a fifth? I mean, there's a lot of questions in that. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you're right about the racing changing. I think in Cadel's era, it was on the change, but it hasn't changed to the extent as when Sky and eventually Ineos got their grips on the Tour because they rode a whole different bike race. But Cadel was still, he had a love affair with the Tour very early on. And back in 1998, when he rode the Tour of Tasmania, I myself and Phil Anderson, the great Aussie cyclist, when I saw how he climbed Mount Wellington, I went up to him and I said, Cadel, you've got to stop riding these mountain bikes. He wanted to ride the 2000 Olympics for Volvo on a mountain bike. I said, you've got to stop all this. You can win the Tour de France, mate. You've got the ability. And he dismissed it. He had a nice cushy contract, I think, with Volvo. And of course, he fell off and broke his collarbone. And he rode the Olympics and I think he finished 7th. So wasted year gone by. Then he turned pro. Then eventually he got to the Tour de France. He won the Tour of Austria in his first year as a pro at the same time the Tour de France was being held. And then he got on to the pro as a big pro. And he finished 5th, I think, in his first attempt at the pro. It was only a matter of time. And when he finally did win it, I remember he slaughtered poor Andy Schleck. Andy's also a very, very nice guy and a good friend of mine. But he slaughtered Andy Schleck in the time trial, just like Roach had done to Delgado, and he won the Tour. But Cadel first of all had to salvage the race to Alpe d'Huez, where Andy Schleck was on fire, and he had to get across huge gaps to save the Tour before he could win it. Nobody would help Cadel. There was no big teams driving. It was Cadel driving, and that's the difference. And so Cadel won the Tour, and I remember jumping over the fence after my commentary ended because SBS, the Aussie company, said, get an interview for us, get an interview. So I jumped over. Well, the Champs-Élysées was packed. It was more people there than on the beach in Bournemouth like there was last week in the middle of the COVID spacing business. And so I got through to Greg, and I grabbed him by the shoulder, said, Greg, it's Phil Liggett. I need a quick word for SBS. And he turned around and he said, you told me in 1998 I could win the Tour de France. I just won it. I said, yes, but you took your bloody time, Cadel. I told you later. Yeah. But that was a great moment. And since then, first of all, I never thought I'd ever commentate on an English rider or a British rider winning the Tour de France. People said, oh, Chris Froome wasn't. Bradley Wiggins certainly was, and that was his win. In 2012, and then came Chris Froome, and then the only man that's interrupted the run is Vincenzo Nibali, who ironically won the race that started from Yorkshire. But I feel that the way they race, they've got the problems. If we do have a Tour this year, they've got the problems with three possible leaders. There's going to be huge fallouts there. You can't have three leaders. But that's not my problem. They've always won the Tour. But it's been a very boring situation. Although they've done it with different riders. I mean, if you think about it, we've done it with 4 different riders. Mm-hmm. It's very controlled. They know it's controlled. That's what they do. They're there to win the Tour. They're professional bike riders. They're using the game as it appears to them. But I prefer a one-on-one bike race and may the best one win. And that's
do you think salary caps would be a good I mean, they're looking at that in Formula One and other sports have salary caps like the NFL. Do you think that would help?
Football in Britain, Premier League and Formula Motor Racing, it's obscene, frankly, the amounts of money that people get. There's nobody deserving of such salaries. But that's what the economy will give them. If you cap, it's hopefully will make a more level playing field because you can't afford, like your fantasy league, you can only have so many high-paid players in your fantasy team and the rest you've got to use to make your team up. I don't know if it'll work or not. There's always a way around everything we ever do, I think. But I think the first thing I do is stop the radios. So there's a lot left to the strength of the human being to get on with it. Sure, have your team captain on the road. The captain keeps an eye on where all his team is and he puts the cards down and say, okay, get up there and help Fred drive at the front. We need that break back, you know, say it, do it. That's okay. Footballers decide where to pass the ball on the pitch. But I don't like driven by a man with a radio.
I agree with you, Phil. Look, I think we've discussed cycling and we could keep talking cycling for days.
3 hours ago. But my dinner's almost ready.
I just want to touch on what you do, everything you're doing in Africa with the rhinos and you're with BirdLife South Africa as well and doing work with them. How is that all operating for you?
Well, that's my real love, of course, is the animals and the future of the planet. And that's I love cycling because it takes us into the planet, as we know it, the countryside. But yeah, you're right. I'm a patron with BirdLife in South Africa. And I do, I'm a patron of helpingrhinos.org, which is a charity here in Britain, but it's all the money goes to the saving the rhinos in Africa. We're just looking to build a new foundation, which is going to be called the Paul Sherwin Phil Liggett Foundation in memory of Paul, because of Paul's ideals we want to continue, which was helping the African people and animals survive in the world. That's really far more important than talking about cycling. We're also, my wife's just reminded me, we have a new company, not a company, but new charity called Freedom to Roam. So we are creating a number of mountain bike events, which will be held around the world. In support of A, the rhinos in Africa, and B, the koalas, which have been devastated after the fires in Australia. And we're working to all these things we can. And we're also bringing rhinos, which are currently in New Zealand being fed, to Australia, where they'll be bred and returned to Africa. And that'll be done in South Australia. All through the people who are helping me have always been involved at the very top in cycling. So that's why I love cycling.
Great. I love all of that. So Freedom to Roam, is that up? Can people find that? Where did they find that?
Freedom to Roam is in the process of, because of the COVID, we had to, although we're holding on to all the deposits, the clients who enrolled, we're going to have to postpone till next year. But that's going to happen.
Freedom and that's to Roam Adventures.
It's called Freedom to Roam Adventures.
Australia and Africa.
Is the website working yet?
No. We think so.
Thanks, Trish. Yeah. Appreciate it.
We don't know where we are with this blinking COVID at the moment because we're turning us upside down.
I'll put that stuff in the show notes for people that are listening. You know, and if there's links and things, I'll write you and we can put those in the show notes so people can kind of support you.
But the helpingrhino.org is helpingrhinos.org. That's the main one which we're working in just now. But the mountain, when we do get this Freedom to Roam going, it's going to be superb. We're going to do rides across South Australia, which will finish up with very privileged entry into certain sanctuaries where you will see the saved koalas who will be reintroduced to Kangaroo Island again. And you'll get access that nobody else will ever get. It'd be very special. And we have all the experts and me to give you a few funny stories as well.
Well, I'll be signing up for that for sure. If I can, if these things open and we can start moving again, that sounds epic. And Phil, I can't thank you enough for your time and all these stories. I think I've laughed more in this episode than any of the other ones. And honestly, next time I just really hope we can sit down with a glass of wine and just share stories because that's absolutely fantastic, mate. I really appreciate it.
Jokes, Greg. But when Paul and I used to give a lot of talks around the States and everywhere else, And people used to think we used to make the stories up. We used to fill halls, 800-900 people used to come along. And we told stories. We didn't even go on stage knowing what we were going to talk about. We finished up with the audience in tears. Everything we tell you is true. We don't make jokes. We just tell you the truth. And you find the truth is often very funny.
It is. It is, mate. One final question. Do you think we're going to have a Tour de France this year?
Do you know, I would still go only 50-50 chance. I know they're going through all the motions. They're pulling their teams together. They're getting it. But the French government have not yet approved the race. And I know the Tour de France has requested that they do, but they haven't, because I don't think anybody knows where we're going just now.
And that can't make plans.
So I don't think you can. I mean, it's a ridiculous situation, but I can understand. I feel sorry for everybody involved. But 50-50 is the best I could say.
I think that's a safe bet, mate. Again, thank you so much. Phil Liggett, the voice of cycling. What a thrill for me. I really appreciate it, mate. Please stay on the line just for a moment. Thank you, everybody, for listening. For show notes, timestamps, and everything else, links, go to bennettendurance.com/media. But Phil, stay on the line. Wow, just absolutely fantastic, mate. Much appreciated.
Thanks a lot for listening to Be With Champions. If you enjoyed the show, your support would truly be appreciated. You can visit the Be With Champions Patreon page, or you can subscribe with your podcast app of choice. Don't miss the next episode, so subscribe and be notified. For show notes, if you want to know more, please visit bennettendurance.com. I'm Phil Liggett, and on behalf of Greg Bennett, here's to the next time, and I hope you will join Greg again very soon.